In Washington, D.C., it is 71 degrees under partly cloudy skies. For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Good afternoon. This is the Shai Rana Show with your host, Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAI-FM.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Zain Lamine with the Shai Nana Show. Welcome to the Global Intifada, or the Global Infitada, as one of our idiot representatives mentioned in her McCarthyist examination of the traitor by the name of Ms. Shafiq, who is the president of Columbia University, an Egyptian-born Arab, and the scum of the earth type person, as are most presidents of most Ivy League colleges, whatever their color may be. And as Dr. Benjamin said, black faces in high places are not going to save us. Anyway, we had witnessed in the past week the death of the politics of identity, or rather identity politics, which Democrats and the Democratic Party and the boomer generation embraces to the death. We've witnessed an Arab, the first Arab president of Columbia University, unite with the first Latino police commissioner of New York, uniting with one of the biggest Uncle Toms in history, Eric Adams, who unrolled everything that Black Lives Matter had achieved. So you have the Black mayor, the Latino police commissioner, and the Arab president uniting together to attack and violently remove peaceful students and staff from Columbia University. What a wonderful world we live in. And I'm so glad that this generation is not buying it. just now, in terms of looking at the revolution that's sweeping the nation, and we're going to have more about that later. But just to give you an update, every day in the past week, there's been a new encampment popping up at a different place across the nation, all the way from coast to coast, from the sea to shining sea, rather. We started with Columbia University that sparked it all. And once the arrests came, by the way, the hundreds of students that were initially arrested and were being taken out in handcuffs, when they came out to the street, they realized that there's thousands coming in to support them. It was a beautiful sight to see these handcuffed, peaceful protesters, these students, look in surprise and joy at the oncoming thousands. And get used to that picture, because we're going to be everywhere. New York University followed. Yale University followed. Emerson College followed. Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, followed. Tufts University followed. The University of Michigan Presidente. Vanderbilt University followed. California State Polytechnic University. It was a beautiful sight, with students carrying water cooler bottles and banging the head of the pigs with them. May we see more sights like this. May we see the end of pigs by the end of the century, or by the end of the decade, rather. University of California followed. University of Minnesota followed. University of North Carolina, UNC, baby. The South rises. The New School followed. Brown University followed. University of Pittsburgh followed. University of Southern California followed. And we're going to see one pop up. You'll hear about it. I'm not sure if it's public yet, but there's going to be an encampment here in one of the DMV colleges. I know that University of Maryland already set one up, but there's going to be another one where all DMV university will converge on that one to concentrate their numbers. So that's happening. Also, I had the pleasure in the last week to witness the Senate vote at the American University for to diversify from weapon sales and military investments. That was what the vote, what the resolution was about, divestment and support of boycott and divestment and sanctions. And the vote was miraculous. I went into the room and I was swimming in a sea of kufiyas. Get used to the sight of kufiyas, ADL, who called them signs for Nazis. And how is a racist organization allowed to stay at universities? Our next project is to kick that racist scum off of our campuses. The other thing that I wanted to mention is that the vote at the American University was 21 senators out of 25, basically, voted for boycott and divestment, which is historic. Nobody expected, I mean, the students expected that because they were confident and they've been organizing, but the staff and the faculty and students who are not activists were really surprised. And of course, they're trying to do whatever they can in terms of intimidation, derision, and illegal maneuvering and doxing to try to stop that. The president of American University, that idiot Burwell, who is a careerist by any measure, doesn't care about the humanity, certainly anti-Palestinian, certainly anti-Muslim, is so cultureless that she doesn't know the difference between Palestinians and Muslims. She actually asked the student that. That's how cultureless these donkeys are that are leading our academic institutions, which are the intellectual arms of this empire, as this generation is finding out and revolting against. So within half an hour, this woman answers that this resolution is non-binding. And of course, the students showed up 2 days later and protested in mass in front of her office, challenged her to come out so they can confront her. But of course, she cowered in the corner because these careerists, they live on fear. And we've seen them go before some of the most backward, Bible-thumping white dinosaurs and cower in front of them instead of telling them some figment of truth, agreeing with them and firing who they're told to fire. These are the same people that are destroying critical education across the country and are trying to destroy critical race theory in Florida. These are the people that are running the show, and these idiots, these puppets that are presidents of universities, are letting them run amok that way, because I think one of the requirements for university presidents these days, especially when in your Ivy League, is to have your spine surgically removed before taking office. And lastly, I want to, as I always do, I wanted to tell you about an action that's happening on the 27th, this Saturday. There's going to be Code Pink, among other groups there. And there's all kinds of direct action and also non-direct action that you can show up and support. And I urge you to do so. And this is an action at the correspondence dinner, which is usually a love fest for the administration. These minions that come out and pretend that they're professional after peddling lies for the last 6 months and for the length of their career. So I urge you to come out to shut down the correspondence dinner in solidarity with the Palestinian reporters that have been killed in mass in record numbers, record at a pace unbeaten in recorded history. To come out to the correspondents' dinner on Saturday, this Saturday at 5 p.m., and that's going to be at 1865 Colorama Road Northwest. Again, 1865 Colorama Road Northwest. Come out to the peaceful demonstration or join some direct action at that correspondence dinner. Ride the wave. The momentum is rising. And as we're seeing across the nation, it's a dark moment, but it's also a goosebump galore moment in the sense of how inspiring it is. The speeches that are coming out, the demonstration, the creativity that is happening. So anyway, we're going to start today with a collection of voices from the past week. There's three segments back to back that I'm going to play for you. The first one was going to be When I See This Flag, What It Means, which was delivered at Alexandria, Virginia City Council. Second, followed by Rashida Tlaib's inspiring speech that talked about that horrible moment where they voted to give $26 billion to military to kill more children and women and men, to kill more innocent people. And lastly, The Masks Are Off at Columbia, which is actually delivered by a professor at Columbia University that is challenging the administration. So let's listen to that, and I'll come back and introduce the longer segment later.
What do I see when I look at this flag? When I look at this flag, I see greed and destruction. I see the biggest weapons producer in the world, and I see defense stocks on Wall Street rising. I see millions of dollars of AIPAC money pumped into congressional pockets just this week. I see Biden wrapping his arms around a despot, and my city hall lit up in blue and white. When I look at this flag, I see your allegiance to Israel, the only country in the world that automatically and systematically charges and prosecutes children in military court. I see a gang of Israeli prison guards threatening and carrying out a rape of a 15-year-old Palestinian boy. I see elected leaders ravaging international and American laws while accusing their opposing political party of being lawless. I see your loyalty to their abandon. When I look at this flag, I see over 32,000 murdered Palestinians and veto after veto at the UN. I see the proliferation of lies of beheaded babies and mass systemic rape, lies of child terrorists, and lies of nefarious humanitarian aid workers. I see the most influential newspaper in the world referring to dying Palestinians but killed Israelis. I see a graveyard of Palestinian journalists. When I look at this flag, I see the torment of weaponized starvation, disease, and thirst all over Gaza. I see the paper skin stretched over brittle bones. I see the flattening of universities, mosques, hospitals, with thousands under their sacred rubble. I see a father clawing at cement with his bare hands, but it's too late. When I look at this flag, I see more than 15,000 Palestinian children slaughtered with U.S. bombs for U.S. profit. I hear the screaming mothers and I cry. I can't stop crying. How are your eyes still dry? I see the ancient olive trees ripped from the earth. I see that same earth vengefully salted. I see the U.S. airdrops that crush rooftops and kill desperate aid seekers. I see the flower massacre. I see hundreds of martyrs made last night. When I look at this flag, I hear your silence, which repeats Biden's promise that there is no red line, that you have no conscience, that you have no soul. No, this is not my flag. You can have it. You might continue to look away, but your flag will not protect you when the memories of your own silence haunt you in the middle of the night.
Today was one of the hardest days for me as a member of Congress. I watched as the votes went one by one up and voting for close to $30 billion of no conditions, no acknowledgement that even a genocide or the killings of thousands and thousands and thousands of children, fathers, mothers, grandparents, the fact that literally many of the people now cannot even recognize their communities, their neighborhoods, memories gone forever. Not one acknowledgement. It was completely a blank check to a genocidal maniac, a complete blank check to the continuation of our own tax dollars to be sent to continue the genocide that is happening in Gaza. The one thing I want to give you all hope, and please believe me, I was there on the floor. The fact that 40 members of Congress said, nope, not this time. That might not be a lot to you all, but this ironclad support that everyone keeps touting, it's not true. They know you all are out here. They may try to gaslight and pretend, no, this is not a problem. But the fact that people are knocking on their doors, they're opening the doors, the peaks and backgrounds, it is incredible to see. People wearing the keffiyeh up and down Rayburn office building, I tell everyone, the same person fighting for immigrant rights is knocking on the doors of my colleagues and saying, today I want to talk to you about ceasefire. So I beg them, and I'm begging, because I don't know what else to do. The stories and the humanity is not changing them. I'm telling them, wake up and understand. You may not see yourselves in the Palestinian people. Maybe that's what it is. But understand that that could easily be any of us when we stand silent and don't understand the importance of shared humanity. Being the only Palestinian is hard, but it's so much harder for my family in West Bank, for the people in Gaza. What we're doing out here in the cold, that's nothing compared to the suffering that they're going through every single hour and every single minute. So again, thank you so much. And again, continue to speak truth to power. Let's end this massacre. Let's end this genocide together. Thank you.
Thank you.
Look, I think today's event show, the charade is over. The masks are off. The Columbia administration can't any longer pretend that it's protecting Jewish students, faculty, and staff from some undefined idea of anti-Semitism. They use those scare quotes there because they use them too. They are persecuting, jailing, harassing, surveilling, intimidating Jewish and all other students, faculty, and staff who are seeking to exercise not only their freedoms of speech and inquiry, but their very obligations as scholars and citizens. Berenice Shafiq's email this morning announcing today's massive crackdown comes hot on the heels of her groveling performance before the MAGA McCarthy Inquisition in Washington, D.C. yesterday. It could not be more transparent or more dangerous. She claims that she consulted with the Academic Senate's Executive Committee before calling in the police to haul off over 100 and counting of our students. That committee unequivocally rejected her call to confrontation and violence. But she proceeded anyway, opening the campus to the NYPD's notorious strategic response group, who set themselves upon our students. Students were sitting on a lawn, peacefully protesting, posing no hazard, no threat, not even an inconvenience to anyone, except, of course, to those in power, who want nothing more than to punish anyone who will remind us that not only the vast majority of Americans, but the majority of young American Jews, and I'm speaking now, of course, as a Jewish faculty member, are sick of our government's support for the ongoing slaughter in Gaza and the West Bank. The events unfolding on the Columbia campus are part of a broad national movement of brave, truth-speaking young people. So in your coverage of these events, don't for a minute pretend that at this point, those young people's sacrifices can be honestly framed as a chapter in some kind of Jewish versus pro-Palestinian political conflict. The hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of signatures garnered just this past week in support of the Columbia Barnard Jewish faculty letter rejecting the weaponization of anti-Semitism attest to this truth. And while some Jewish faculty and students, and of course, trustees, and just like some fundamentalist Christians and far right leaning other folks might want you to believe otherwise, the facts are the facts, and it's time to report them. Jews in America are rising up to say, not in our name, more loudly, more clearly, and more fearlessly than ever. And they're proud to join fellow humans, such as our students, who are willing to risk so much to make their voices heard.
That was when I see this flag delivered at Alexandria, Virginia City Council, followed by Rashida Tlaib's inspiring speech after she witnessed the horrible vote by our so-called representatives to give billions of dollars that could have gave us healthcare, could have canceled the student debt, that could have built the infrastructure that's falling apart, where we have bridges falling down in Baltimore and cities like that, where we don't have drinking water in Flint, Michigan. The last one was the masks are off by one of the many anti-Zionist Jewish faculty members talking about the truth of what's happening at Columbia. And now we're going to listen to a longer segment from our beloved Electronic Intifada, which has been doing amazing reporting. And this will cover, there will be five students from the five different campuses that have risen up and established encampments in the wake of the Columbia University uprising. So let's have a listen to that.
Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm Nora Barrows Friedman. Across the U.S., students are mobilizing in defense of Palestinian rights and in direct opposition to their university administration's relationships with Israeli institutions and investments in corporations that aid and abet Israel's genocide in Gaza. Israel lobby groups have mounted escalating attacks on students who support Palestinian liberation and have worked with university administrations to crack down on student activism and speech. At the end of October last year, when Israel's genocidal attacks on Gaza were already in full swing, the Anti-Defamation League and the Louis D. Brandeis Center, two of the top right-wing Israel lobby and lawfare groups in the U.S. masquerading as civil rights organizations, sent letters to hundreds of U.S. universities urging administrators to, quote, immediately investigate their campus chapters of Students for Justice in Palestine over, quote, potential violations of the prohibition against materially supporting a foreign terrorist organization. Just a few weeks ago, the ADL's director, Jonathan Greenblatt, compared the Palestinian keffiyeh, the traditional scarf worn by Palestinians and people around the world who support Palestinians, to the Nazi swastika on national TV without any pushback by the television hosts. Earlier this year, the Columbia University Administration suspended the campus chapters of Students for Justice in Palestine and Jewish Voice for Peace. And then in early April, after students organized an event focused on Palestine, the administration suspended five students and issued eviction orders from student housing with only 24 hours notice. At Pomona University in Southern California in early April, The Guardian reported that 18 students were arrested and charged with misdemeanor trespassing, and one student was arrested for obstruction of justice, according to the Claremont Police Department, during a protest in response to the removal of pro-Palestinian art on the college campus. Students were led away by dozens of cops in riot gear. The Guardian added that at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, at the same time, three students were expelled, one suspended, and 20 were given probation over their involvement in a sit-in protest on March 27th for Palestine at the campus's Kirkland Hall. The protest was in response to the school administration removing an Israel divestment question from student ballots. And repression by administrators at Harvard has reached unprecedented levels, students say, where every Palestine-related event is under intense scrutiny by the administration, and student leaders have been evicted and investigated by the university. In February, the MIT administration suspended the Coalition Against Apartheid for fighting for Palestinian liberation. They have further issued sanctions letters to 13 student organizers, threatening them with permanent suspension from MIT. And at the University of Pennsylvania, students faced possible administrative discipline for screening a documentary on Zionism. There are so many other instances across the U.S. on college campuses, it's hard to keep up. But joining us today are four students from Harvard, Columbia, MIT, and the University of Pennsylvania. Sophia Oguntipe is a senior at MIT studying chemical biological engineering and has been an organizer with the MIT Coalition Against Apartheid since 2021. Leah Kayali is a student organizer at Harvard Law School and community organizer with the Palestinian Youth Movement in Boston. Her family is from the occupied interior of Palestine. They were exiled in 1948. We have Sabira from the University of Pennsylvania, who is in her junior year and has been a part of the fight in advocating for Palestine on her campus. And Kay from Columbia, who wishes to remain anonymous because of the mounting attacks, both from the administration and Israel-aligned groups. Welcome all of you to the Electronic Intifada podcast. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
So I want to go around and have you each lay out what's been happening on your campuses in terms of both Israel lobby repression, administrative repression, and how students have been organizing to fight back. Leah, let's begin by having you talk about what's been happening at Harvard Law School.
Sure. So I go to Harvard Law School, and in coalition with students at the other Harvard campuses, we've been organizing since October against the genocide on our campuses and have seen severe repression from the university. As you mentioned, you know, friends of mine have been removed from their housing, from their positions of employment from the university, have faced investigation both by law enforcement and by the university police. And so we've seen real escalations in response to oftentimes very mild protests. I'm under investigation by the disciplinary board of the law school. So just in response to speaking in the student lounge at our school. So we've seen like that even this, you know, extreme level of repression against, you know, the most mild of dissent. And I really think the reason for that is because these institutions, and I'll just speak to Harvard in particular, are deeply embedded in and bought into the death cult of Zionism. And so I think when we talk about repression, and when you look at the picture of Harvard in particular, the intervention I think is important for people to understand, and that I would want to make here is that, Harvard is invested not just materially, financially, but academically and intellectually in the project of Zionism in a way that sort of leaves them no choice but to, cow to every Zionist attack that we've seen happen in the last 6 months. And, you know, you could take any one of the thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of catastrophes that have been wrought upon my people. And if you were to trace it back, you know, you would see Harvard's fingerprints all over it. A friend of mine recently told me the story of his, childhood friend whose son was martyred after just, you know, going to his room to pick up his toys. And then that particular room was struck by a bomb. And because it was in the area of the Ashifa medical complex, that family couldn't leave their home and was forced to be in the room with their son's rotting body for 4 days. If you take even just this one example of something that feels personal to me through a friend, you know, you think about the bomb that was dropped might have been an Elbit Hermes drone, and Elbit is poaching employees from Harvard. You think about the Israeli military officials who okayed that bomb, and they maybe are people who are beneficiaries of the Wexner Fellowship at Harvard. Then you look at the American side, the politicians that approved those sort of targeted killings and, you know, allow for the military budgets and military funding packages to go through. Statistically, any large number of them are Ivy League educated, including at Harvard. Anthony Blinken, obviously, being an example of someone who went to Harvard. And so I just mentioned that to say that when we look at the level of repression that students are facing on campus, we can see that it is because of Harvard's investment, which is why our demand as student organizers has been divest, but also to think of divestment expansively, not only in the way that all capital is often invested in genocide being wrought upon my people, but also the way that Harvard has provided political and intellectual cover for Zionism as it continues to commit these crimes for the last 6 months. So that's really been what our organizing has been centered around. We did pass a divestment resolution at the law school, and they have been following it at other school, graduate schools at Harvard. The undergraduate recently tried to put a divestment bill forward, and it was actually blocked by just a few Zionist forces in the administration and student government, very undemocratically. So we're seeing this repression happen to students, and it's really because of the investments that Harvard has, which is why our call remains to divest materially and academically from Zionism.
Phenomenal. Thank you so much, Leah. Sophia, you're very close to where Leah goes to school at MIT. You're a senior there. You've been organizing for several years. Talk about what's happening at MIT. I mean, you know, it's just, I mean, and all four of you are students of very elite, you know, Ivy League institutions that purport to be, you know, beacons of academic freedom and democratic thought. And, you know, what has it been like organizing for Palestine on MIT's campus? What have you been facing?
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. On the sort of idea of these colleges, you know, espousing these sorts of values, I think at MIT, when you walk into like Lobby 7, which is like our main lobby, there are these like giant banners that like show like MIT's values. I think it's like belonging, curiosity, something like that, which is interesting because when we had a protest there in November, the administration's response to our, you know, curiosity and our sense of community was to threaten almost 100 students in there with suspensions. So obviously there's a bit of a hypocritical element to the image that these institutions like to purport about themselves and what they're actually doing. In terms of the organizing at MIT, we've been, you know, doing things around genocide since October. We put out a statement pretty early on, engaged in some of the Boston area protests, and then started having protests on our own campus. I think a lot of our campaign at MIT, just given the technical nature of MIT and how embedded we are in like producing technology for not only the US war machine, but for Israel, has been focusing on those research and technology ties. So right now we have been really looking at MIT's research relationships with Israel. So MIT receives millions of dollars in research funding from the Israeli Ministry of Defense, like directly from the Israeli Ministry of Defense. Like you go onto like our like vice president of research, you go onto like the like report they put out at the end of each year, and it's literally the Israeli Ministry of Defense is like giving money to researchers, to faculty at MIT to do projects. And these are not innocent projects. I mean, they wouldn't be innocent regardless, but like we're talking like autonomous robotic swarms. We're talking underwater persistent monitoring. And this is money that is coming directly from the Zionist entity through the Department of Defense in the US and then into MIT. And these researchers are doing these projects with that funding. And so there's this very explicit relationship that MIT has where we are producing like the technological capabilities, both through research that is directly funded by the Israeli entity, but also just generally, like we have so much technology, so much of MIT is funded by the Department of Defense. And a lot of that technology will still end up benefiting the Zionist entity. And so that is something we've been focusing on a lot at MIT, is how do we as students and workers, so both undergraduates, a lot of undergraduates do research, but grad workers especially do a lot of research. How do we kind of take back that power and say like, no, we're not going to allow our labor to be used for genocide, to be used for occupation. So we released this Scientists Against Apartheid pledge. I think right now we have over 1,000 people signed on to it. That includes about 500 undergraduates, which is like 12% of the undergraduate population at MIT, which is great. And it's really just about like saying to the institute, like, you know, no, you cannot use, you know, this labor force to continue to push this project of Zionism. out into the world. And so that's one campaign we've been doing. Another campaign that we've been looking at, because I mean, MIT just has so much complicity, is also another issue. That was something we always struggled with even before October 7th, is like, what do we focus on? And I think the Israeli Ministry of Defense funding was one thing that we really wanted to hit on. The second one was this Lockheed Martin seed fund for Israel that faculty can apply for, where they can collaborate with a researcher in the Israeli, in Israel, to basically just, you know, start some sort of seed project. The money comes from Lockheed Martin. They prioritize projects that work with UAVs, that work with quantum sensing, all of the sorts of things that Lockheed Martin would want. And it's been really interesting campaigning against this specific fund, because we've been accused of, oh, you're targeting the manager of this fund because he's Israeli. And so now we're going to investigate you guys on anti-Semitism and on harassment based on protected class, which are two charges, which are the charges that I'm currently dealing with. You have the people who like manage the fund claiming like, oh, it's not a fund of war or of genocide. It's actually a fund for climate change. The projects that we choose are for climate change. And so then you have this like greenwashing of a fund that is funded by Lockheed Martin to do research with Israeli researchers that prioritizes fields such as UAVs and quantum sensing, and they're gonna tell us it's a climate fund. And so there's this kind of culture at MIT that we're also kind of pushing against. That is kind of unique because we're such an engineering and technology heavy school. And so I think it's been really interesting to see students push back on just our overall culture, not just with our relationship to Zionism, but our relationship to war and genocide throughout. But in terms of repression, so as you kind of mentioned, we had a rally in February. It was right after right after some attacks in Rafah. Like February 11th, February 12th, somewhere around there. And so we had an emergency rally. And MIT basically, after that rally, they suspended the CIA and they sent sanction letters to 13 organizers. We managed to get it dropped down to 8 eventually, basically saying, you break another rule, we will have grounds to permanently suspend you. And that was kind of interesting because we're also dealing with this sort of new protest policy that's been rolled out this year, which is basically that you have to register your protests like 3 business days in advance. You have to like pick one of these approved protest locations, and they so conveniently dropped the list of approved protest locations the day before we were about to have a protest in a non-approved protest location. And so we're also kind of dealing with that side of things of, you know, how do we continue to push back against this protest policy? Because this is not something that will just affect us. If we allow this new protest policy to stay in effect without any sort of pressure against it, like that's going to affect student activists going forward. But yeah, in terms of repression, so there are the sanction letters, which actually the sanction letters that came after the Rafah rally, we actually managed to basically clear. They've kind of gotten rid of those, which are good. But we still have 7 students under investigation from back in January, myself included, for a protest that we did against that Lockheed Martin fund that I was talking about earlier. And that protest was in November. And then we got the sanction letters in January, like a day after Claudine Gay resigned from Harvard. And there have been a couple of instances where we'll see an instance of repression on our campus very soon after something else happens on another campus, and they'll always tell us it's not related. But you know, we know that administrators talk just like we talk. And so, yeah, that's the main thing that we're dealing with. We've had some instances relating to the police. Luckily, nothing to the level that we're seeing at, you know, Pomona or even locally at Brandeis. We've kind of been following those, and our hearts are with those students who are kind of facing that level of brutality. But there has been like increased police presence on campus. There's a police officer stationed in Lobby 7 in that main lobby that I mentioned. He's stationed there all day, every weekday. We had a teach-in back in the fall semester that was totally registered, totally just a purely educational event. They ended up locking the doors and stationing 3 police officers in front of it right after the protest that we had. And they really gave no justification as to why they did that. Of course, we know why they did that. They basically just wanted to shut us up after that protest that we had in November. But I think police presence is also something that is really galvanizing the student base at MIT because, you know, groups like the Black Students Union and the Black Graduate Student Association have been fighting for years to try to reduce the level of police presence at MIT. And get rid of cops in emergency situations on campus. And basically all it took was a couple of Zionist students to complain about our protests. And now there are cops everywhere. There's cops by the Religious Activity Center. There's a cop stationed in Lobby 7. There's just way more cop presence on campus. And so it's kind of interesting to see which student voices get thing that the administration immediately responds to. Because like I said, almost every community of color has complained about the cops before. We had whole committees that they put these students through to come up with these recommendations to try to reduce the presence of cops on campus. And it took the span of like 3 months for that to be completely undone and then some because of Zionist students who want to quash our protests. And so we're seeing these connections between not just people who are struggling for Palestine, but also a lot of the struggles that like Black students and other students of color have been fighting for on campus. And so I don't know, it's been interesting. Obviously the repression is not great, but it has been a really good opportunity to sort of coalition build in a very material way and in a very real way that I don't think has existed on campus before. And I think admin is not quite ready for the level of students collaboration that they're probably going to have to deal with in the next couple of years.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. Thanks, Sophia. Sabira, you're at the University of Pennsylvania. Tell us what's been happening there in terms of both student activism around the genocide in Gaza and also administrative repression.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me and then also for everyone who spoke before. It's interesting because a lot of these themes and acts of suppression have been just present on our campus as well. It definitely seems that like, you know, all of our suppression and repression are interconnected, especially on the front of over-policing, targeting of students for just the premise of being pro-Palestine, especially because Penn started to get a lot of the heat after Harvard, after other schools. We were able to protect ourselves in very, cautious manners, especially as our comrades and like fellow organizers from Harvard got a lot of the brunt of the violence. Penn Against the Occupation, the main SJP adjacent group on campus, had released a statement very soon after the acts of resilience on October 7th. And many student groups had signed on, but considering the doxing that happened at Harvard, obviously many students had to protect themselves and obviously, not risk, their entire safety. Many students, especially undocumented students on our campus, have been specifically doxed or put in very uncomfortable situations. It's very interesting on our campus. It's actually not just been the university that has put students in uncomfortable positions, but students themselves have, especially from the Zionist student groups and spaces on campus. Specifically for myself, I've been studying abroad for the last year and haven't been able to physically be on the ground to actually advocate and organize. But being someone who is concerned and especially very, very shocked about the response from my university community about the genocide happening in Gaza. That's undeniably a genocide. Students have been preying on each other's social media, talking to each other, particularly from the Zionist community, in order to actually attack and give names and identify students, even if they aren't directly a part of student groups, which is really concerning, considering that although I haven't been on campus to specifically organize, my name was added onto a list of students that were put on Canary Mission amongst other websites and have faced violent threats to my own family, as young as my 6-year-old cousins being given very violent threats, which is unjust. And the university still hasn't, responded to that, which is really, really concerning. Similar to Sophia, it's very interesting because Zionist students have been able to complain that they have felt uncomfortable by mere acts of saying free Palestine or let Gaza live, very simple and not well, Free Palestine has been controversial, but Let Gaza Live, you know, of people living in their home, which shouldn't be controversial, it has caused a very easy way for the disciplinary committee at Penn to just get names of students and force a disciplinary case on them. As many of the Zionist students who have been very loud and proud of the growing anti-Semitism on our campus by scapegoating specific students, specific groups, specific actions to the smallest extent to give students disciplinary cases. One of which was really concerning, that was students have been identified from mere security footage for putting stickers on, you know, poles on campus that say Free Palestine, Let Gaza Live, simple, you know, slogans and, you know, statements. And students have been given disciplinary cases by that, just by identifying them due to specific, like, clothes that they have worn repeatedly. The university definitely has cracked down on certain students and is not willing to discriminate those students based on simple actions. There's actually been a very concerning situation that happened recently where students were simply chalking on campus, and active chalking is used by many student groups, you know, to promote upcoming shows, you know, promote, you know, elections that are happening, anything like that. But students, a part of the pro-Palestine groups on our campus, were swarmed by 6 to 8 campus police officers and detained, you know, unjustifiably for 30 minutes until other students had shown up in solidarity to just say, like, what is the issue? Campus security wouldn't budge, and they were asking for identification. But knowing our rights as students, saying that we're violating and damaging the school property, the property that we pay for. By the way, it was spray chalk. You know, you can just pour water on it and it'll be gone. You know, detaining students on their campus, that's very unsafe. And even after this, students were followed home. That's very dangerous about, like, you know, considering on Penn's campus, students are required to live on campus for 2 years. Our home is our campus. And if we're followed home, how can you be safe? Especially considering the growing disciplinary cases of students being rejected housing, like losing their housing because of their advocacy. Are we students, or are we just, you know, pawns to the liberal agenda of what seems like liberal education, which I find really concerning. I didn't mention what I study, but I do study Middle Eastern politics. And there have been cases where students in classes have specifically been called out and been reported to disciplinary cases based on something they said in class. If we in our classrooms can't feel safe to speak our mind, to call it a genocide, what it is, to say that Palestinians deserve the right to live, to the right to talk about the right of resistance, the right to freedom, and, you know, all these liberal ideas that we all talk about every single day. You know, we talk about South Africa, we talk about all these different liberty movements, especially on our campus. You know, Penn is placed in the black bottom of Philadelphia, and we have indigenous acknowledgments and talking about the black people who are displaced and ongoingly displaced in our community. But if we talk about these lofty ideals but actually can't act on them during an actual genocide, it's really concerning, considering also Penn has a direct relation with you know, certain programs in the West Bank where students from Palestine actually are a part of our community. This isn't a separate idea where students, like, there are no Palestinian students on our campus, that there are just only Palestinians from the diaspora. There are actually Palestinian students from Palestine on our campus that are suffering, being scared and put into silence, who lack support. And it's really concerning. But yeah, it's been a very wide-ranging idea of disciplinary cases, where a really concerning recent instance was when through a very mild act of resistance, a study-in where students had just booked a GSR or a study room in our main library, we only had put flags and banners alongside the walls so people could obviously not pretend that they're in, like, a world that the genocide isn't occurring, to keep their awareness running. Students were studying silently, And during the study session, administration had come to the room to ask for the flyers and the banners and the flags to be taken down. Students had complied, but despite this, students during that study in are now facing escalated disciplinary hearings that are not just solved by what normally happens is an essay kind of talking about the situation, but now they're being forced into a hearing to actually, you know, talk about the seriousness of just studying in a room and having a flag up, just because some Zionist students were complaining about how it made them uncomfortable. The reality of the situation is that Penn is not absolved from the hands of the violence and, you know, from the West Bank to Gaza to the pre-1948 territories. Penn actively manufactures, innovates, engineers the newest technology used to police, surveil, and, you know, murder innocent Palestinians in the homeland. Recently, a new campaign that's been going on is to target Pennovation, that actually is famously known for engineering the robotic like war dogs. I don't know the specific language, but they're known for having engineered the robotic dogs that are used to monitor and surveil Palestinians. And although this has been a larger campaign, not just on our campus, but from the entire concerned Philadelphia community, the university has specifically barred from our main SJP group, Pen Against Occupation, from endorsing this action because it risks most like similarly to other campuses, our recognition as a student society. Because if we are able to endorse this action, we're suddenly going against campus violations. But last time I checked, advocating and standing in our grounds for our values, I don't know how that's against university violation when we have six and more.
There was several students from the different encampments around the country right now that are basically leading the way in terms of this revolution that's happening, this uprising. This is what we call in Arabic intifada, that's happening across the nation and across the world. And as you heard, these are especially schools like MIT that are very much involved in the technical aspect of empire, in terms of basically of colonial conquest, and in terms of supplying the kind of weaponry that are being tested on Palestinian citizens right now and then sold worldwide. Even as the Israelis massacred Palestinians in the thousands, and even as their northern front basically was cleared because of the retaliatory attacks by the Lebanese resistance, and even as they lose the ground war that they're actually waging not waging against Hamas, they're actually just really focused on killing citizens. And the corpses, the hundreds of corpses that have been found now under Al-Shifa Hospital, shows that the massacres that happened at that hospital were really deliberate. And especially then you find men and women in scrubs, in their hospital scrubs, tied and had been shot after they had been tied. And doctors who refused to leave their patients' side were first shot in the limbs, and when they still hesitated to cooperate, they were killed. They were taken and killed. This is the most depraved country right now in the world, what they're doing. And it's not just what they're doing, it's the fact that they're admitting to it. They're bragging about it. Everything, every lie they've told about October 7th, they actually committed, whether it's rape, sexual violence against men and women and children, whether it's shooting innocent civilians in the hundreds that were not doing anything, whether it is the use of human shields, which have been proven false, or whether it's the helicopters that play the sounds of the crying babies so they can attract Palestinians that come out to help and shoot them. How depraved is that last one? How depraved, and it's actually happening. Thank you for listening, and please tune in again next Wednesday, and don't forget to attend the correspondence dinner and shut it down this Saturday. This is Zain al-Amin signing off.
If you remember Freestyle Union from back in the 90s in D.C., or if you ever heard jazz legend Steve Coleman playing with a virtuoso rapper, or if you've just been keeping up with what's going on in the DMV right now, then you know the artist that is Kokai. One of DC's most original talents, an author, improviser, storyteller, and 2023 Guggenheim Fellow, Kokai comes to Songbird Music House on April 28th for a special concert with his live band presented by Capital Bop. That's Sunday, April 28th at Songbird in Northeast DC. Also on the bill is Baltimore's Conjure Collective, a new group you won't want to miss. Info at capitalbop.com. That's CAPITALBOP.com.
For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. A letter released today, signed by hundreds of former and current athletes, is urging the NCAA to not ban transgender athletes from women's college sports. The letter implores the NCAA to, quote, promote a healthy and safe environment for all athletes, not discriminatory attempts to sideline an entire group of athletes from the sport they love, end quote. The letter was signed by athletes on the collegiate, professional, and Olympic levels, including WNBA legend Sue Bird and U.S. women's soccer co-captain Megan Rapinoe. The NCAA did not directly address the matter in a response, saying instead that it will continue to, quote, ensure fair competition. A separate college sports body, the NAIA, approved a policy earlier this month banning trans athletes in women's sports. The U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments today in a case challenging a strict anti-abortion bill from Idaho that took effect after the court overturned federal abortion rights 2 years ago. Idaho is one of 14 states that ban abortion at all states of pregnancy, with very few exceptions. White House lawyers have argued that the Idaho law and others conflict with federal health care law that requires hospitals receiving federal funding to provide abortion care in emergency situations. Conservative justices, who hold a majority on the court, asked questions that suggested skepticism of the White House argument, while liberal justices said the Idaho law put women's health at risk. The court already allowed the Idaho law to go into effect as the case plays out. President Biden today signed a $95 billion foreign aid bill passed by the Senate last night after months of debate. The package includes $61 billion for Ukraine, $15 billion in military aid for Israel, $9 billion in humanitarian aid for Gaza and other war-torn areas, and $8 billion in security assistance to deter Chinese aggression in the Indo-Pacific.
It's a path to my desk. It was a difficult path. It should have been easier and it should have gotten there sooner. But in the end, we did what America always does. We rose to the moment. We came together and we got it done.
Biden said $1 billion worth of weapons from the package would be rushed to Ukraine. But lawmakers warned that much damage has already been done to Ukraine's war effort, with Russia collecting significant victories in the past several months and Ukrainian troop morale low. The White House had, for months, pleaded with lawmakers to approve additional aid for Ukraine in particular, but some conservative Republicans had pushed back against providing additional aid. The foreign aid package also includes legislation to force the Chinese owner of TikTok to divest from the popular app, which more than 140 million Americans use. About one in four U.S. adults over the age of 50 say they have no retirement savings, and nearly 3 in 4 are concerned about inflation outpacing earnings, according to a recent AARP survey. The survey found that housing costs and other everyday expenses are the main reasons people couldn't save for retirement. It also found that 1 in 3 older adults carry significant levels of credit card debt. The data matters as election season heats up, as older adults tend to show up reliably to vote. Newly released census data says voters 65 and older comprised over 30% of the electorate in the 2022 midterm elections. And nearly 40% of people in the U.S. live in areas with unhealthy levels.